Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 2nd, 2006, and today's session is entitled Wilderness and the American Mind, presented by Norm Moline, number MON2006-03. Let's listen in.
I'm delighted that you're here. And the session tonight is going to be focusing on something that obviously I think almost everybody in the room likes. Or you might not go to Holden, you might go to Holden in the middle of some city instead, but you like to be in the wilderness. But my name is Norm Moline, for the record. I teach geography at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. And one of the themes among many that geographers look at is the human-environment relationship. And one of the things I teach is a decision-making model. In which we look at all kinds of variables, natural science and economics and technology and law and all of that. But sitting outside the parentheses is perception. How do people think about something? Because in the end, every one of us in the room is illogical. There's not a person in the room who's objective. We all somehow bring certain backgrounds into our decisions and we make into our minds, and we make our decisions based upon those perceptions. So for those of us who try to understand why do people or cities or counties or anybody, why do they make the decisions that they do, we say you got to begin by looking at perception. Some groups like the Corps of Engineers and the others, they say, well, we got to get right to the scientific studies of the floodplain or whatever. And we say, well, let's first we ought to have some study about the perceptions of things. Well, in this case, perception of wilderness. And in that sense, I became interested in this a long time ago, traveling on vacations, of course, and teaching it from some of the earliest years in teaching. And then came this wonderful book. And the reason I'm really glad that you're here is to put in a pitch for you to buy this book. Most of what I say tonight is going to be a review of this book. It's available in the bookstore. I think they're selling it up there for $16.95. It's Roderick Nash's book, Wilderness and the American Mind. The first edition came out in 1967, and he's come out with subsequent editions now, the fourth edition all the way up to 2003, was it, or 2000 even, 2001. When I bought it, and I like to read, but I can't say I'm one who regularly buys books that I can't put them down. But this is one, when I got it, I read it on a vacation, and I could hardly put the book down. And over the years, I've recommended it to students. If they want to get a one-credit independent study, do this book and the other one that's listed up there, Alfred Runty's The National Park Experience. And I haven't had one student give a bad review. If you're interested in nature, if you're interested in the development of people in the United States thinking about wilderness. And so this is the book I'm going to be reading some sections, kind of using it as the outline. I'm going to be adding some new material in there, from Runty's book. I've got a handout to give to you, and some other things. So it isn't totally out of this book, but most of it is. And I don't, in this case, I don't feel bad in case somebody would say, gee, you were sort of brought out here to kind of give your own lecture on this. I don't think you can do any better. If you and I are interested in wilderness, read this, and you can fill in now. It's up to, with his latest edition, 390 pages. He's added about 5-6 chapters since the initial one first came out. One qualifier about the book, particularly as I've been thinking about it the last and using it the last couple of years, as good as the book is, the reality is that it's mostly wilderness and the white European-American mind. There's not a lot of, very little discussion in here about the African-American attitude toward wilderness, and there have been enough other articles to suggest that they, most, because of their circumstances in the U.S., often having little opportunity to come to Nash Parks or wilderness areas, it's hardly on the radar screen. And certainly Native Americans would have a different view. Probably, I can't say this for sure, but probably Hispanic Americans would have a different view. Some Asian Americans who come over, brought over some of their ideas out of the Buddhist tradition, out of the Taoist tradition, might have different attitudes. So in that sense, we could say Nash's book is behind the times. On the other hand, I wouldn't go that far because the reality is in the history of decision-making in the United States, what he's talking about has guided decision-making about setting up the park system, setting up the Forest Service. All of those things essentially have come out of European, Anglo-American decision-making, and that's what he, I'm sure, would admit. He's an accomplished scholar at Yale, and if he were blatantly, for bad reasons, neglecting the others, people would be all over his case. So with that qualifier, let's plunge into this book and where did the things begin? It's a history lecture tonight, and that is that the first chapter talks about a wilderness condition. When people first came over to the U.S., wilderness was seen as bad. And he cites another site. You can go back to the biblical tradition where when Jesus was tested, he goes to the wilderness. And Moses, for the length of time in the wilderness, is if things are a little tough or you want to be tough on somebody, send them to the wilderness. That's where they're really going to be tested. The untamed aspect of nature was not perceived very well. De Tocqueville, when he visited the United States in 1831, said this: in Europe, people talk a great deal of the wilds of America, but the Americans themselves never think about them. They are insensible to the wonders of inanimate nature, and they may be said not to perceive the mighty forests that surround them till they fall beneath the hatchet. Their eyes are fixed upon another sight. The march across these wilds, draining swamps, turning the course of rivers, peopling solitudes, and subduing nature. William Bradford himself, when he came to Plymouth Colony, some of the terms that were used there: gloomy, dreary, unhallowed wilderness. Wilderness was not seen to be a good thing. Now, Nash says there were two components of this bias against wilderness. It was a formidable threat to the pioneer's own survival. The pioneer needed safety, comfort, food, shelter, and all of those depended on overcoming the wild environment. The dominant criteria was utilitarian. Nature is out there. Tame it so you can use it. Quote, the pioneer lived too close to nature for appreciation. Conquest was the major concern. We're going to talk about this later, but in the last chapter of Nash's book, when he's thinking internationally, that same theme comes back, and we'll explain this a little bit more, but in a nutshell, the people throughout our history, and now in the world's history, the people who tend to appreciate wilderness are the people who don't have it anymore, but have a good civilization. And the people who don't care about wilderness are the people who don't have much of an economically developed society yet and actually still have, in their judgment, quite a bit of nature. Cut the stuff. Drill the stuff. Tame the stuff. We got to do something to increase our society. And so here we have it initially. We had a lot of nature here, but the goal was first,
what is Native Americans? I mean, the Native, I think sometimes it's a little overblown, but they talk a lot in their, when they're about their traditions of respecting nature, an awful lot in their,
artwork
we have. Is that a little bit different?
Oh, it would be. That's, again, this does not talk about that. This is talking about the people who ended up then dominating North America. Nash does not talk about the Native American presence because that would have been the Native American presence, not this developing American mind of the late 1700s, early 1800s. That's a weakness of the book. He doesn't bring in the Native American, so that's, as we said, that's the qualifier. So that's not going to be in any of this discussion. But we all know they were essentially pushed out, and it didn't shape U.S. policy. Here's one last quote. Countless diaries, addresses, memorials of the frontier period represented wilderness as enemy, which had to be conquered, subdued, and vanquished by a pioneer army. The same phrase persisted into the present century. An old Michigan pioneer recalled how as a youth he had engaged in a, quote, struggle with nature for the purpose of converting a wilderness into a rich and prosperous civilization. Historians of westward expansion chose the same figure. Quote, they conquered the wilderness, they subdued the forests, they reduced the land to fruitful subjection. So that's one component of the anti-wilderness bias or antipathy. The second is wilderness then was a dark and sinister symbol. It shared a long Western tradition of imagining wild country as a moral vacuum, a cursed and chaotic wasteland. You battled nature in the name of nation and God. Here is a quote. Civilizing the new world meant enlightening darkness, ordering chaos, changing evil into good. Wilderness was the villain. The pioneer was the hero. To transform the wilderness into civilization was a reward for human sacrifices, was a definition of your achievement. This is what I did. Look what I conquered this section of the country. And it became a source of pride. That's where we began a couple hundred years ago. Then he moves finally, not finally, but only into chapter 3. We start to get the good signs of where eventually we end up 200 years later. He defines that as the romantic wilderness. The romantic wilderness comes along. Interestingly enough, appreciation of wilderness began in the cities. Quoting again from Nash, appreciation of wilderness began in the cities. The literary gentleman wielding a pen, not the pioneer with the axe, made the first gestures of resistance against the strong currents of anti-wilderness. The ideas of these literate people determined their experience because in large part they saw in wilderness what they wanted to see. The concept of the sublime and picturesque led the way by enlisting aesthetics in wild country's behalf, while deism associated nature and religion. God is in nature, so we ought to save nature because the Creator is in the midst. Combined with the primitivistic idealization of life closer to nature, these ideas fed the Romantic movement, and that began. And this began then, the flowering of the Romantic period was in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. The solitary, mysterious, and chaotic qualities were coveted. One person, one thing nice about Nash, he's got so many good quotes in here, different people that probably some of you have read, but he cites one here from a William Byrd, who idealized the useful pastoral nature. This is a fellow who owned a plantation down in Virginia. If we just cut the trees down, that's okay, but let's retain just enough so that we have this nice sense of nature around the plantation. So it was kind of a mixture of the two. Tame it, but keep a little bit. It was picked up then by these urban literate Americans, but by and large, indifference and hostility generally remained dominant, even when the Romantics were writing. But we're starting to get a few cracks in the door in the early 1800s. Then, chapter 4. This becomes more interesting then, I think. In this one, he calls it the American wilderness. There was one last quote I wanted to have from the Romantic. William Cullen Bryant's would be added that of many other early 19th century Americans, a kind of an ambivalence. Opinion was in a state of transition. While appreciation of wild country was beginning to exist, it was seldom unqualified. Romanticism had cleared away enough of the old assumption to permit a favorable attitude toward wilderness without entirely eliminating the instinctive fear and hostility of nature. So it was kind of, we want some, but not going to jump too much into it. Then comes this American experience. The second source of enthusiasm was the fact of independence. After we gained our independence, we had to justify who we are and why are we any different from anybody else, and what's going to justify our long-term existence. Do we have much literature? No. Do we have any great architecture? No. Do we have any famous sort of historical background? No. What's the one thing we have that Europe doesn't have? Aha! People began to say, we got nature. We got mountains and rivers and forests like nothing is left in Europe. So Nash calls this chapter the American wilderness. America's primary task was to justify its newly found freedoms. They were looking for something uniquely American. yet valuable enough to transform provincials in different parts of the country into proud and confident citizens in America. And so in that context, with a short history, as he says, weak traditions, minor literary and artistic achievements, all of the U.S. seemed negligible to Europe except nature. And here, one of the first quotes, this is again from page 67 in this book, the nation short, I already mentioned that, in at least one respect, Americans sensed that their country was different. Wilderness had no counterpart in the old world. Wilderness was actually, and now talked about as an American asset, not something to be feared or chaotic, which it had been only 50 years earlier. But by the middle decades of the 19th century, wilderness was recognized as a cultural and moral resource and a basis for national self-esteem. Particularly not after, he doesn't note this, but I would add this, it's not so much after the War of 1776, but after the War of 1812. Okay, now we beat the Brits the second time. It looks like we're going to be around. And some of you may know that's when places like upstate New York began to name their cities like Rome and Utica and Ithaca, thinking we're going to be around. We're going to be around as long as Greece and Rome. And so then all, that's about the time when they're thinking, okay, we're going to be around, but what's going to justify our uniqueness? And then this. Yes, sir?
So would you say that the American wilderness, is that where the national parks would come into play?
We'll get to that. That's still about 40 years down. It's still coming. But this is the first crack that comes along. This is Abigail Adams. Some of you know her. In 1786, she wrote this. I will not dispute, she remarked, what every person must assent to, that in Europe the fine arts, manufactures, and agriculture have arrived at a greater degree of maturity and perfection. But in some respects, the New World has the edge. Do you know that European birds have not half the melody of ours? Nor is their fruit half so sweet, nor their flowers half so fragrant, nor their manners half so pure, nor their people half so virtuous. But leading off that, we got better birds, we got better nature than they have in Europe. Abigail Adams, 1786.
John Adams' wife helped him run the country, the third president.
Yeah.
Thomas Jefferson's notes on Virginia was in part a rebuttal to the European notion of, that America was inferior in many ways, including, animals and plants and all of that kind of thing.
Sure, Nash has got a nice section on Jefferson's letters from Virginia. So that's one set. Then a few years later, in 1855, there are a lot of other things we could note, but this one I thought was interesting. A coffee table book came out, The Scenery of the United States Illustrated, in 1855. As usual, there was an introductory essay, and this one defended the American landscape as being, quote, as wild, romantic, and lovely as can be seen in any other part of the world, and certainly our forests, fresh as it were from the hands of the Creator, are beyond dispute incomparable. So that's clearly kind of a notion that we have something to be proud of.
Mm-hmm. Does Nash make reference to the Hudson River School painting, beautiful landscapes by Benjamin Church and
That comes up a little later, too. He's a little bit later, but he certainly picks that up. So that's now we've got a couple of things going for us, and that is the romantic sense, and now we add a sense of national pride. And into that time frame comes Henry David Thoreau. So chapter 5 devotes strictly to Henry David Thoreau. He was born in 1817, but the document that is so famous for any of us who understand the wilderness came at a lecture that he gave in Concord, April 23rd, 1851, the Concord Lyceum. I wish to speak a word for nature, for absolute freedom and wildness. Thoreau promised his statement would be extreme in an effort to answer the numerous champions of civilization. Quote, let me live where I will. On this side is the city, on that side the wilderness, And ever I am leaving the city more and more and withdrawing into the wilderness. Near the end of the address, he concentrated his message in 8 words. In wildness is the preservation of the world. And maybe some of you can buy posters in Seattle or Portland or Chicago or any place in the nature place. You probably can find one that has this quote on it. It's one of the more famous ones in wilderness history. In wildness is the preservation of the world. Nash says, Americans had not heard the like before. Wilderness now was cited something separate from an American ideal or asset, separate from what the Romantics were saying. This cut new channels of thought for many subsequent ideas. Wilderness was seen by Thoreau as a reservoir of wildness, vitally important for keeping the spark of the wild alive in each of us, in people. The crucial environment was within. Wilderness ultimately was significant for its beneficial effect on thought. The rural, for him, was the point of equilibrium. And those of you who have studied anything about Thoreau, they don't put this in print, but with my students, I say he was actually the first suburbanite. And of course, oh, people, you know, they cringe at that. But here's what happened when Thoreau really went to wilderness. He lived, you know, Walden Pond right outside of Boston. He could go in and drink and talk with Emerson and the buddies in Boston. And then we'd had enough of that. Then he can go back out to the pond and walk. And then he writes about, oh, how beautiful nature is. But then a few days later, he can go back in to Boston and talk with the people at the pubs and back out. He really liked both. But finally, he thought he'd go north. While Thoreau was unprecedented in his praise of the American wilderness, his enthusiasm was not undiluted. Encountering the Maine woods underscored it. Thoreau left Concord in 1846 for the first of 3 trips to northern Maine. His expectations were high because he hoped to find genuine primeval America, but contact with real wilderness in Maine affected him far differently than had the idea of wilderness in Concord. Instead of coming out of the woods with a deepened appreciation of the wilds, Thoreau felt a greater respect for civilization and realized the necessity of balance. The wilderness of Maine shocked Thoreau. He reported it as, quote, even more grim and wild than you had anticipated, a deep and intricate wilderness. Climbing Mount Katahdin, he was struck by its contrast to the kind of scenery he knew around Concord. The wild landscape was savage. Imagine, this doesn't sound like the Thoreau we read elsewhere. The landscape was savage and dreary, and instead of his usual exaltation in the presence of nature, he felt, quote, more lone than you can imagine. Speaking of man's situation in wilderness, he observed, quote, vast, titanic, inhumane nature has got him at disadvantage, caught him alone, and pilfers him of some of his divine faculty. That's why he's a suburbanite. He wanted to be able to balance the ability to go to, and maybe many of us, huh? Would many of us want to stay up here for the rest of our lives with this is only Holden? Maybe, but maybe it's fun to be here for a week or two knowing that, okay, so it's fun to talk and interact with cities and go to concerts and go to museums and all of that. So maybe there's a little bit of Thoreau in each of us. But nevertheless, for his own part in regard to wilderness, Thoreau felt he lived a sort of border life. Occasionally, he sought the wilds for nourishment and the opportunity to exercise his savage instinct, but at the same time, he knew he could not remain permanently. A civilized person must at length pine there like a cultivated plant which clasps its fibers about a crude and undissolved mass of peat. For an optimum existence, one should alternate between wilderness and civilization, or, if necessary, choose for a permanent residence partially cultivated country. So that leads to some of the paintings where you see there's this idyllic little lane and the woods are there and a nice little farmhouse and some stone fences going across. It's a modified landscape, but geez, does it look idyllic. And a lot of those pictures have sold and a lot of them are hanging around the U.S. to this day. And people say, I'm living in the city, but boy, isn't that a nice picture? And you say, that's modified too. But in any case, here's Thoreau. He did open eyes to some things. The next chapter is preserve the wilderness. more people started to pick up on Thoreau-type thinking, almost transcendental value of nature, plus or the American or the Romantic. You got several streams coming together. Now people are starting to say, we got to save this. Appreciation of wilderness led to the sadness at its disappearance. The idea began to show up of deliberate preservation. One that he does not cite in here, but Runty talks a lot about it and others do, we can thank maybe Niagara Falls for the fact that we have some Western national parks. Niagara Falls was, obviously we know what it's like, spectacular scenery, but there was it was all preempted by private business in its initial years. And they turned it into a freak show. All along the sides there were businesses. They had actually, they had a wire going across the channel back at that point. And people would, you know, have this and all kinds of other commercialism. And people would go up there and you kind of had to fight your way. In the 1830s, you had to fight your way through the commercialism to be able to see the true beauty. Then when people began to see out west, but nice waterfalls, oh no, not going to let Niagara Falls happen here. And so the bumbling of the Niagara Falls, bumbling in the sense of the inability of the private sector to sort of manage and maintain it in a way which really preserved the beauty itself, prompted people to think, we may have to step in. There's got to be a different way than simply leaving it in the private sector. So some things began to occur. One of the first, in fact, Nash cites George Catlin. Some of you out west know his name, maybe more than we do in the east. An early student and painter of the American Indian was the first to move beyond merely saying, oh, I'm sorry to see some wilderness being lost, to move from merely regret to actual preservation. He was the first. He wrote a number of things, but in the 1830s, he described it this way, fascinated with this idea of a major park. He was thinking out west here where maybe Indians and buffaloes in the wilderness somehow might find a way to coexist. And he says, what a beautiful and thrilling specimen for America to preserve and hold up to the view of her refined citizens and the world in future ages. A nation's park containing man and beast in all the wildness and freshness of nature's beauty. That's in the 1830s.
Oh,
yeah. So that's Catlin. He's bringing this up. And then finally, we can cite, I'm trying to cut this down, the number of quotes, but we come upon another key person who shows up, and it actually links up with the morning Bible study. When Barbara Rossing was talking the other day about what had happened to the Mediterranean world, and the cutting of the trees, and that she was saying that maybe some of the bad things of the Roman Empire ought to end, among those were what had happened to the Mediterranean. I didn't want to raise my hand at that point, but George Perkins Marsh, a key person in U.S. ecological history, he was a diplomat, had spent a number of years in different parts of the world, but he was in the middle, in the Mediterranean area, and he saw what had happened, and what's even to this day, some geography books will talk about that as, quote, Mediterranean vegetation. But much of what is called Mediterranean vegetation, that is vegetation which will survive hot, dry summers, would have been in the Mediterranean world for sure under forests. And all you have to do is walk around here and note the difference in the microclimate if you're out in an open area as opposed to underneath. And you can, we don't have time to go through this, but essentially the Mediterranean world as we now know it, from Spain all the way to the east end of the Mediterranean and all across North Africa, is a human-made, a vegetation and environment, the result of human mismanagement of the land. And George Perkins Marsh saw that in 1864, wrote a book, Physical Man and Nature, or Physical Geography as Modified by Human Action. That book is such a classic that Harvard republished it again about 10 years ago now. Nice hardback copy you can buy and set it on a coffee table. George Perkins Marsh, because in that book, George Perkins Marsh basically said, in a nutshell, a big book condensed down, look what the civilizations of the old world, Greeks, Romans, Egyptians, Israelis, Lebanese, all the rest, look what they did to that world. We better not let it happen here. Wake up, don't cut the trees. And so for those of us who study ecological things, George Perkins Marsh is often considered one of the first ecologists. And therefore, he is speaking out at about the same time that Catlin is doing these things, and there comes to be a move to preserve wilderness. Not just talk about it, not just to regret it. Let's take specific actions to set it aside. The next chapter, and the first one, the first major bill, it's not the first national park, but the first time of something was taken was in 1864. Yosemite Park in California. When that land was federal land, they gave it to California so that California could set it aside as a park. So we always hear about Yellowstone, we don't hear about Yosemite, but that was the first action by the government for that, primarily because it made protecting wilderness compatible with progress and economic welfare. Marsh's arguments became a staple for preservationists. There's economic sense in doing this. However, it was the 1864 federal grant of Yosemite Valley to the state of California as a park for, quote, public use, resort, and recreation. The area was only 10 square miles, and a flourished tourist and catering business soon altered its character. But the legal preservation of part of the public domain for scenic and recreational values created a significant precedent in American history. 1864, a date to remember. Imagine, it's during the Civil War. I always continue to find that all the stuff, well, Lowell knows that as a historian, a lot of incredibly important stuff happened in the Civil War related to the United States. The Homestead Act, the Transcontinental Railroad, the designation of the first wilderness. Sometimes it gets lost in the discussion of the Civil War years, and some incredibly important decisions were made in the U.S. then regarding how we're going to distribute our land. Please.
Was this a gift to California for staying with the Union or for aligning itself with the Union, perhaps? It's hard for me to believe that in 1864 there was enough consciousness of a wilderness as a valuable place for that to be the de facto motivation.
It wasn't the only factor, but it was certainly a key one. And in terms of the document, whatever the motivations were, probably several of them coming together, the fact is it was given only with the condition that it be kept as a park. It could have been given for some other reason, as happened in a bunch of other states. In this case, it was given for the express purpose that it be set aside for recreation and resort and recreation, and that hadn't happened before.
Was Marsh a friend of Lincoln?
I should know that, but I don't remember that detail in the book, whether he knew him or not. He was a diplomat. He wasn't an environmentalist, so probably working within the confines of U.S. diplomatic, he probably knew the presidents.
Yeah.
I should double check that. Well, what happens then, and here we can for now depart a little bit from that, we know then things begin to happen. In 1872, March 1st, 2 million acres were set aside in Yellowstone National Park. But as some of you know, I think in the case of that park, it was mostly set aside because it was a freak show. It was an oddity. I mean, whoa, these bubbling geyser things and these mud pots and all of that. It wasn't that it was beautiful and untouched wilderness. People could see, if they could do that with Niagara, oh, imagine what a private entrepreneur could do with this crazy stuff coming out of the land in Yellowstone. But the fact was that 2 million acres were set aside. Help yourself to one of these. We're going to have a look now how things really begin to spiral kind of quickly for a while. So you get some, and yeah, obviously you can take this with, and I hope you'll have some fun looking at this later, and especially if you buy the book. We did do a little bit of setting aside in the Arkansas Hot Springs, but then we've got the Yosemite, and I got plenty. Now we're going to take a few back. Then we got the Yosemite Act, the Yellowstone Park Act. We have in 1885 the Niagara Falls Reservation established, and that is they forced them through a variety of things we don't want to discuss, where private profiteering spectacles gave way to some parks for the public. to enjoy Niagara Falls, so that when you and I go now on both sides of the river, there are some public facilities. Another one that isn't noted on this particular handout, but one which should be, which was important for this history, in the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York, in 1885, the Adirondack Forest Preserve was set aside, 715,000 acres. The reason that is important, it's one of the first times in which it really was watershed management. That one was set aside again, not because it were beautiful trees and where people could go and enjoy animals. The Hudson River drains to New York City, and New York City was worried about the quality of the water going by. And they knew enough that if we want to have an adequate supply and somewhat decent water quality going by New York, we better set aside that land in the north. I love that story. It doesn't even get as much publicity. It's one of the first times in the U.S. in which you set aside land up there in order to benefit people down here.
What was your date?
1885, the Adirondack Forest Reserve, 715,000 acres. It comes out to, what, almost 100 square miles. And that area, as you know, still is popular recreation time. So we have some good things happening, and you see some of the other events that occur shortly after that. I don't want you to jump too far ahead, but Mount Rainier Park Act is 1899. Another one that isn't on there, but that was in 1891, the Forest Reserve Act. Some people had begun to sort of penetrate and say, we shouldn't allow the trees to keep on being cut. 1891 and another key act in 1987, the Forest Management Act. These became the key guidelines for national forest policy, well, much of which we still have today. So that's, things began to happen. The next chapter talks about one other person to note during this time period, and that's Frederick Law Olmsted, the developer of Central Park. Doesn't really, Nash doesn't talk much about Olmsted, so I'm bringing that in. But Olmsted did Central Park in 1853, did Mount Auburn Cemetery in the outside of Massachusetts, which was really the first one in the 1830s. They thought their cemeteries ought to look kind of nice instead of just being these stark places. For the poor mourners, they should have a nice environment, and also if heaven's supposed to be a nice place, why do we bury people in these stark, stark places? So put those two together, he created Mount Auburn Cemetery, just a few miles from Harvard. In Cambridge, well, they found out people go over to Mount Auburn Cemetery just have a picnic. Even if they weren't going to mourn anybody, just go over and walk those beautiful lanes. You ought to put that on your list of things to see if you've never done it. You go to Boston, just go west of Harvard Square, about 2 miles, and there you'll see Mount Auburn, and you'll drive through it. Now, it won't be that different from some of the other cemeteries around the country now, but that was a first. And then people began to say, gee, if this is what we would like, something that kind of resembles nature, maybe let's just have something like that without having to bury people there. And so that's where the Central Park idea was conceived, and that was 1853. We know in Chicago, we follow Olmsted a lot because the first suburb in the United States, Riverside, Illinois, was 1869, which was about 9-10 miles outside of Chicago. And Olmsted, and his thinking kind of picked up a little bit on Thoreau's ideas that, oh, the cities are dirty kind of places and corrupting places, and that's where people work, and the streets are covered with junk and so on. There should be what he called a counter-tide movement. Instead of just moving to the cities, there should be a counter-tide movement to allow people with means to be able to work downtown, hop on the train, which is what it is, the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy line went right from Chicago out to Riverside, about 10 miles out, and there create a rural ideal. And that's what, to this day, Riverside, Illinois, houses sell there for about $700,000. But it's an incredibly beautiful place, and it started the suburban trend. I only note it here because Olmsted wasn't just creating an environment. He said, people will be made better if you have them in a good environment.
It's true.
Yeah. If you put people in that environment, they will be better. That was his argument.
That's Jefferson.
Well, it was his, yeah, but Olmsted's the one who actually took it and put it into place as a landscape architect. The idea is it's, you don't just do this for beauty. People will deteriorate. They will become savage if they're in cities. The only way you can raise the human spirit is to allow them to have contact with nature. So I think it belongs in Nash's book to go with this. Well, then we move to John Muir. Chapter 8 in this book picks up on Muir, again, an incredibly important individual. He would live from 1838 to 1914. There had been, even though we had saved a few things in the late 1800s, there was still no national movement. The other things that were the big things that were happening in the late 1800s, as many of you know, the Homestead Act, giving away land if people would tame it and put up farms. The Desert Land Act, give them even more if they would tame desert land. There's a Grazing Act that came out a few years later. Instead of giving them just a quarter section of land, give them 640 acres if you would convert it into grazing. So all of this is going on. So while we celebrate Adirondacks and Yellowstone, the prevailing mood still was, we got to tame the West. And then you head into that all the Native American wars, or the wars with and suppressing the Native Americans. You don't really have any national mood. So if you're going to have a national movement on wilderness, you needed a champion. And Roderick Nash credits John Muir with that title. He began in the 1870s to explore and extol the values of wilderness as a way of life. Many of Muir's ideas merely echoed the deists, the romantics, especially Thoreau, but he articulated them, this is again Nash's words, he articulated them with an intensity and enthusiasm that commanded widespread attention. He was a great publicizer. He just didn't have the ideas at his desk closet, but he knew how to get out and organize people and get a number of them. His books were minor bestsellers, and he was a superb lecturer. As I suspect some in the room know, he's the one who created the Sierra Club in 1892 and served as president for 22 years until he died. So he's the one who started the whole ideas, many of which continue, about this. And some more pieces of property began to be set aside one by one, and we don't have to document them. One other thing, though, during that time period that I want to note for you, and it's a key one, this was a time in which a variety of conservation issues were being talked about in the country. And including among those discussions was a gentleman by the name of Gifford Pinchot. Not too far from here is the Pinchot National Forest. The prime of John Muir's life coincided with the advent of national concern over conservation. At first and superficially, the problem seemed simple. Exploiters of natural resources had to be checked by those determined to protect them. Initially, anxiety over the rapid depletion of raw materials and so on caused many people to embrace these views. A common enemy united the early conservationists, but they soon realized that as wide differences existed within their house as between the savers and the exploiters. And I stress this because this goes on to this day. As many of you know, it's one of the big issues in managing of wild lands. The schism ran between those who defined conservation or preservation, setting aside of lands, as the wise use or planned development of resources. Pinchot was worried about what was happening in the country, but his idea wasn't you don't set it aside. We want to find simply good ways to manage the land. So soil conservation, forests, all that kind of thing he's talking about. But let the farmers be there, let the timber people, let the grazing people do that. We'll just work with them so they can use the land in a wise way. That's Pinchot. On the other hand, there would be those who have been termed preservationists with their rejection of utilitarianism and advocacy of nature unaltered by people. Juxtaposing the needs of civilization with the spiritual and aesthetic values of wilderness, the conservation issue extended the old dialogue between pioneers, tame the land, and romantics, set it aside. And as I say, that keeps on going. After a period of vacillation and confusion, Muir ended inevitably by opting for the preservationist interpretation of conservation, while others followed Gifford Pinchot and the professional foresters into the wise use school. So we don't talk too much about forestry in this lecture, but he's the one who bent the ear of Teddy Roosevelt. So the whole development of the U.S. National Forest System, 1891, the wise use policy in that 1897 Act, et cetera, into the early 1900s. As you know, you go to a national forest, some of them are very nice, but they're also grazing animals there, they're cutting trees. The trees in Pinchot's eye, that's just a crop. He'd spent time in Europe, and in Europe, trees were a crop. They just don't harvest every year. It may take 50 years for them, but they're a crop. So let's treat the forest as a crop, but let's manage it as a wise crop. Well, Muir and Pinchot didn't exactly get along, and I thought it would be fun here to lighten it up a little bit. Here's how it happened. These two, they tried to get along, and they became actually fairly good friends. It must have been fun to sit in on some of their conversations in the 1880s and 1890s as they argued which is the way to do it, because in the end, they were really still thinking for something good for America, but how do you get there? The decisive blow to Muir's confidence, to Muir's confidence in forestry came late in the summer of 1877 when he and Pinchot met in Seattle. They had not seen each other since the Forestry Commission meeting of the previous summer, but this time there was no camaraderie. Pinchot, acting on his philosophy that natural resources should be used, albeit wisely, had released a statement to the Seattle newspapers approving of the grazing of sheep in the forest reserves. For Muir, this compromise with the hoofed locusts, that's what he called the sheep, hoofed locusts, was intolerable. Confronting Pinchot in a hotel lobby, he demanded an explanation. When Pinchot admitted he had been correctly quoted, that is, that they were okay to be there, Muir shot back, "Then I don't want anything more to do with you. When we were in the Cascades last summer, you yourself stated that the sheep did a great deal of harm." This personal break symbolized the conflict of values that was destroying the cohesiveness of the conservation movement. It goes on in Congress today on how we should use the national forests and how we should use the national parks. And the present scheme, of course, is mostly use it. It wavers from administration to, but even with other administrations, it continues to be a challenge. But then even my wife, we sometimes debate it. Like it or not, the forests are in the Department of Agriculture, and we're not going to be able to change that, and so therefore it's a long-term crop, but it isn't the best environmentally. Anyway, some good things were happening despite all of that. Yes, please.
Yeah, already back in when the Yosemite Act was established, within 15 years of that time, I guess it must have been Congress that whittled that back to by one-third. Mm-hmm. So that happened back then, even though it was given to California to be used as a public park, yet Congress changed that. And that's what's going to be happening, or is happening now.
Some of that has been happening. That's right. In different places, there's some ebb and flow on it. By and large, it's been an increase. In most parks, it's been an increase and a growth of areas, certainly a growth in the area of the National Park Service, more and more areas set aside. But you're right, there have always been some adjustments in size along the way. He's got a whole section here on the wilderness cult, which I intentionally, even with the time, if we would have had plenty, I still would have skipped that. But there begins to be a lot of people who just want to get in on this. It's really the beginning of a wilderness cult, of which there are still folks around. He has a whole chapter in here on Hetch Hetchy, the big damming of the waters up near Yosemite. The first proposal for Hetch Hetchy came out in 1882, the idea of possibly building a dam there. Various things happened, but if the wilderness people finally lost in 1913. There was a huge national campaign to stop the dam, but they lost. Why does Nash include it? Because that loss, he argues, mobilized the people. Okay, we lost Hetch Hetchy. That's the last time that came to be some of the rhetoric. We're not going to lose anymore. And he has some basis of, there are some really good things that begin to happen when you look at your chart. For example, in 1916, the establishment not of just a single park, but of the National Park Service as a network. And that opened the door that, okay, we've got some so far, but we're going to have a lot more. And that act is one certainly that you want to note or highlight on your page, the 1916 National Park Service Bill. Then a couple, don't have too much more time, but we're in good shape anyway. Aldo Leopold comes along, Midwesterner. Aldo Leopold was born in the 1880s, and the strength of Leopold in this whole discussion, he's the one who really saw the interrelations of organisms and their environment. Beginning back with his book, Sand County Almanac in Wisconsin. He was born in Burlington, Iowa, but they had some property in Wisconsin. He's the one who really saw that we got to manage this whole system together. not for the American ideal or the romantic ideal or setting aside oddities or something like that. We got to set aside lands because that's where the land needs to be managed as a unit. All the organisms, from the smallest to the largest, including human beings, somehow need to work together. That's where Leopold came in. Preservation for Leopold was a matter of scientific necessity, not just sentiment. An ecological conscience, a land ethic. And my colleague back at the college who teaches one of our environmental courses, without question, he's going to have those students read the Sand County Almanac in the midst of all this environmental literature, because there, all the other stuff, either these romantic or these other ideas, were good. It's not saying they aren't good, but Leopold added the extra dimension of the ecology. All environment goes together, and we know that now. Some nice quotes here about Leopold. Leopold realized that unless a change in attitude toward the natural could be brought about, disharmony and sickness would continue to characterize those parts of the earth people had civilized. Initially necessary was an ecological conscience, teaching people their true place as a dependent member of the biotic community. It would encourage people to see land as a whole, to think in terms of community rather than group welfare, and in terms of the long as well as the short view. That's Leopold. Again, read the book. It's got more. The next chapter is Decisions for Permanence, and that whole chapter begins to move through a whole series of legislations which are here, which, again, I had no intention of going, but a lot of things begin to happen, and particularly for those of us, I went to college 1960 to 64 and then right to graduate school. Boy, there were, and many of some of you in the room may be about the same vintage. Gee, and there were a lot of good things that began to start taking place in the late 50s and in the 60s. And from the point of view of the wilderness discussion, 1964 is the culmination of the Decisions for Permanence. The Wildlife Wilderness Act signed into law, initially with 9 million acres, and it's expanded since, and all we have to do is walk down the trail where we have one. A place set aside mostly based on the arguments that Leopold advanced. Ecological points of view. And that's Decisions for Permanence. Then the next chapter, and again we only have 5 minutes left, the next one is Toward a Philosophy of Wilderness. I think if you get the book and read that, that's I found it a tough chapter to plow through, because in the previous chapter, Nash says, by the 1970s, the U.S. had a coherent, consistent policy toward wilderness. But then after that chapter, he adds chapter 13, in which he talks toward a philosophy. And he does sort of conclude where we just were a minute or two ago. But you read through this whole chapter, and you kind of get a repeat of this sort of fishing around for what's the real reason for setting this. Is it because to take care of the God's creation? Is it romantic? Is it because it's America's asset? Is it because it's important for ecology? Is it important to set aside, well, I didn't even mention this, but one of the reasons Leopold set aside, not only for the ecology, but so much of the rest of the world has been civilized, if we want to have any place left or we want to see what it was like before we came, what true nature was like for scientific purposes, we better save this kind of as a bank, a nature bank. So you can, not I say fight your way through, but any of you particularly study this may find it fascinating how difficult it has been to arrive at a single philosophy of wilderness. I don't think we still have a single philosophy, and I'm not saying that's negative, but probably in this room, if we would have had a two-hour session, I would have asked you write down what you would like in a wilderness experience or what it should be, and I'll bet we'd end up with a variety of different reasons why we ought to save it. And that's, I'm not sure, and I don't know that it necessarily is bad that we don't have a single one. Okay?
Well, I'm worried about what's happening in 2005 when they repealed the roadless area conservation rule. Now they've been really fighting about drilling oil up in the North Pole area.
And I wrote in my notes.
These are not good things that are happening to our.
I wrote. I wonder if Nash comes out with another chapter, if he'll have one on decisions for impermanence, because what's happening is some of the things that we thought were permanent now are being re-questioned, and that maybe they don't need to be permanent. Maybe we should sell off parts of the National Park Service. We can't maintain them all. That's been proposed. Maybe more forest wilderness areas should be reopened again. So whereas Nash describes those as decisions for permanence, maybe the current chapter, one of them will be this. We just have a few minutes left. I want to make sure I highlight the chapter called The Irony of Victory. After this long haul, as you know, we've been pretty successful in setting aside a lot of land in the United States. It's over 85 million acres in the National Park Service, 191 million acres in the Forest Service. Yes, it's managed, but it's much of it is still woodsy-like, and we could go on some of the other ones. But the irony of victory is that now people have caught on so much to it that we're loving it to death. We're loving the parks to death. And Nash cites four revolutions. One that caused this, the intellectual revolution, and that is enough people have caught on in the nation that, yeah, wilderness sort of goes along with nationalism and apple pie. Sure, we want to keep wilderness. So that's one. The other one he calls it the revolution of equipment. Tents, camping gear, trailers this, trailers that, overnight this, and you know, you go down the list, all things that make it quite easy even for relatively amateur campers to go and sort of tolerate a wilderness. So they're flocking there. And so they have to put limits, as you know, even here. Only 12 of us can go. We were thinking, we had in our notes, 5 years ago, you could have 16 people going on the Hart Trail. Now I think you said it was 12. And that happens on many of the wilderness trails. There's a limit on it. Okay, then there's also the transportation revolution. So many people now can hop on a plane from Chicago, fly out to Seattle, come over and go into a wilderness, fly out to Denver, and you go on up and to do that. So the transportation revolution, and then the information revolution. Everybody can turn on the web, and you can get wilderness guides and maps, and this is how you find that this is a tolerable trail, it's a difficult trail. Put all of that together, and a lot of people are going to these places. And so, ironically, here we worked so hard to be able to set aside lands, and in our very success of achieving wilderness, now we may ruin them by overuse. And so in the chapter, when he talks about the irony of victory, even at the very end, the epilogue in this book, he suggests that there are three main problems confronting wilderness. And one of them is development pressures of one form or other, on the edges or very close to it. Second is the popularity, which we've already noted. And the third gets to, again, if we would have had 2 hours to discuss this, if we'd say, what's the question? Well, how can we deal with this problem of overuse? Well, you have to manage it. And that means we have to set aside the areas which are wilderness or which are national parks, which don't often match the habitats of the elk. They don't match the habitats of other animals. They don't match the natural watersheds. They don't match the biomes. But we have to do it. He ends up concluding that in the act of designating this is a wilderness area, we already have made it no longer true wilderness. I hope you follow that sense. We've already stepped in, and we're now having to manage it. And so it's almost an oxymoron, isn't it? Wilderness management. But Nash concludes in the end, we may be able to deal with development pressures, and we may be able to deal with popularity. But on the wilderness management, yeah, it's compromising the very notion of wilderness, but it's the only option we have. It's the only option we have. We simply will have to find ways to preserve, because it's all that we have left. And again, working with you, but particularly working with college students, I worry about whether it's the national parks or the forests or the true wilderness areas. The United States population now in about 2 months will hit 300 million. By 2050, we're going to be 410 million. I can't imagine, and I always think of parks, if Yellowstone and these other places are crowded now with a base of 300 million generating people who like to have a wilderness or park experience, or ecologists who want to set aside zones, what will we do when the country has another 110 million people? Some percentage of which are going to want to go and experience these. I wish I could be around to think about the solutions, but that's going to be a huge challenge for this next generation of wilderness managers. People are dedicated, so I think they'll come up with something, but it's going to be a challenge, I think, to do that. And one of the key points, and then we're going to have to stop, and he brings it up at the very end, what is the view that you and I have about parks, and particularly wilderness areas? Do we take an anthropocentric view, That is, we want to manage the parks for the sake of the people who want to use them, or do we manage the parks from the point of view of what the ecology needs? And that's the biocentric view. And which of those two is going to prevail in Congress? And I think we know which one's going to prevail, which would probably not be the one that the scientists would hope would be. The anthropocentric view is going to prevail unless there's somehow a miracle that scientists are able to get enough votes on their side to go against the human wish. That's a tough call. So I hope you'll get involved with this. I hope you'll read the book. I hope you'll read Runty's experience. And at this part here, is there a way, I invite you to think about it, we've had this long history of when people tend to be poorer, the needs of civilization have taken priority. And that he talks about that even in the U.S. And areas of the country. If you get people in a remote part of New Mexico where those people are struggling somehow to get some kind of income off the land, are they really interested in setting that aside as a desert national park? No way. They're interested in figuring out how they can get a grazing permit to get a few more cattle on that land. They're going to still be wanting to put the value of economic development over this. Do we get over here? The question for you and I to think on, is it possible, both here and overseas, to have places that are still developing the economy of civilization, way over at this stage, to still be willing to set aside, as the economists call it, marginal value, how much are they willing to spend for the next unit of that? Is there some way to have this take place even when a country is over in that stage?